Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Blog Talk Radio and Three Women, Three Ways. Today we only have two women. One of us is out of town and doing other things. But we have two of us, and Pinkley, Connie Sue, is one of us, and I'm Heather, the other one. So, Pinkley, why don't we start out by you giving us a little intro to who you are?
Great. Well, good morning, Heather, and good morning, listeners. Pinkley is my nickname, and it's Connie Sue Brown. I am a survivor of domestic violence, and I've been in the field for the last going on 15 years as a survivor working in the field. And a trainer, educator, and most important, an advocate for other survivors.
Oh, great job. Great, difficult, but very worthwhile job.
Right.
I don't work directly with clients. I am a survivor as well, but I tend to look at things more clinically. I kind of had to separate myself emotionally. So I went back to school and got a master's degree focusing on domestic violence, and now I'm working on a PhD, almost done with those classes and ready to start my dissertation. And, of course, my dissertation will be about domestic violence victims and survivors and the employment issues that they face afterwards, after they go through the divorce and or domestic violence episodes. So that's our background, and today we're talking about parental alienation syndrome. I don't know how many of you have heard about this. It's quite popular and has been for about the last 20 years to use that terminology, parental alienation syndrome. And
Heather, what does that mean? Wow, those are big words.
Well, basically what it is, supposedly, is that one parent will say and do things that turns the children against the other parent, okay? It's used a lot in child custody disputes by perpetrators of domestic violence. We talked in a previous show about how perpetrators tend to be the ones who fight for custody of their children rather than just working out an agreement or going for joint custody. They want it all because, of course, domestic violence is about power and control. And so a great way to have power and control is to have the kids. So they're the ones, for the most part, who actually go to court and fight for custody of their children. I mean, the statistics show that it's a very small percentage of parents who actually go to court, and of that percentage, a huge number have domestic violence in the background. So,
well, Heather, I interpret this conversation and this information about the power and control, and as we know, children are often used by an abuser as a way of threatening a woman. I'm going to take the kids, I'm going to report you to Child Protective Services. I mean, they really end up being this terrible pawn in the middle. And it's not really that the perpetrator or the abuser really wants to have custody.
No.
I mean, they don't want really the full-time responsibility. But the fact that they know that they can use this as, again, a power and control mechanism.
Right.
And
personality thing. That,
right.
You know, I'm the winner. That's how abusers look. I'm the winner. You will do what I instruct, what I say. It's all about the power, whether it's what we're having for dinner or how you clean the house or how you who your friends are. It's all about that control. So I can control you very well if I have your kids.
And it's such an intimidating and I would imagine a fearful, fearful experience for a person who has children. I want to invite our guests to call in, too. And it's 646-378-0430. If you have comments or questions about this really interesting topic that actually Heather's done quite a bit of research on. So I'm very excited to hear more about this, Heather.
Okay. Well, you know, as I said, usually with parental alienation, you're dealing with, if not an outright abuser, somebody who has real control issues. And the whole idea of parental alienation was started by this guy called Gardner back in the 80s and early 90s. And Gardner was a very interesting guy. He had views on pedophilia that most, like 95% of all sexual abuse reported by children was phony. That if a husband sexually abused his children, it was the wife's fault because she wasn't taking care of him that way, and he was forced to go another way. I mean, he was really kind of a creepy, crawly guy.
Wow.
And he's the one who started this whole idea of parental alienation, and he made quite a living going from court to court to court to court testifying about parental alienation. Now, nobody has ever officially defined something as parental alienation. The American Psychological Association says, nope, bogus, there's no science behind it to prove it. It's a made-up syndrome. And the Law Association says, nope, it's not legitimate to use this in court. Nevertheless, you get judges who will buy into it. And for a woman who's fighting for custody of her kids, if she's accused of parental alienation, she's quaking in her boots. Because there are a lot of judges who will actually not only buy that, but who will assume that it's true, that the woman being, you know, nasty creature that she is actually trying to alienate the children away from the father, because why else wouldn't they want to see him? I mean, can you think of another reason why children might not want to see an abusive person other than the mother is poisoning their minds? I mean,
well, that's a great question, and I can think of many different reasons. And the primary reason is that the mom would want to protect the kids or the partner of this relationship. And this is I, as a survivor, didn't have children as part of my experience. I've worked with many people who have had child custody issues, and in the county that I work and advocate in, over the last several years that I was the legal advocate, only knew of one particular case where that became an issue. And the experience overall was that the attorney, it was like, I have this label that I can hang everything on, and that was this parent alienation syndrome. And it just sounds like a terrible psychiatric mental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But yet my experience working with this survivor is she was doing everything she could to keep her children safe.
Yeah.
And not only was there domestic violence, there was alleged sexual abuse by the perpetrator or the respondent or this person that was claiming that it was a parent alienation syndrome. And she just had an incredibly difficult time. Once something like that has been labeled or put into some court papers, to defend that, how would a person defend that, Heather?
Well, I don't know, to tell you the truth. I just don't know. I think the only real defense is to educate judges, because ultimately judges, you know, lawyers can say, oh, it doesn't exist, and psychologists can say, oh, it doesn't exist, but if the judges don't buy it, it may as well exist, because if judges are using that to determine child custody, wow, you know, I mean, that's hugely inappropriate, and yet they do it. Again, it depends on the court. Some courts are very, you know, some court jurisdictions are very well-informed, and they just kind of poo-poo it. But some jurisdictions actually, some judges actually buy into this and go, see, those kids don't want to go visit him. They are fighting, you know, going with him whenever it's his turn to have them. She must be poisoning their minds. Well, hello, does it occur to anybody that kids don't want to go to somebody who's mean to them?
Yeah, and then it seems like the emphasis then is removed from the actual issue about safety,
mm-hmm.
why this why a mom or a wife or a partner initiated potentially legal action to keep her children safe. And now it becomes almost what it appears or it's feeling like is that now they have a tactic to turn it all around. Now it becomes about this one particular issue, and you end up fighting in court about whether or not this issue is valid, real, made up. Then you get into an argument about this one particular thing as opposed to focusing on the real issues at hand.
Well, remember a few shows ago we talked about what I see as the tenets, the three tenets that courts operate under. And two of those tenets are that a man has a right to his children.
Mm-hmm.
The other tenet is that children need a father. And the third tenet is women lie. So if a father is going into court saying, she is keeping the kids from me, courts go, whoa, we can't have that because you have a right to your children and your children need a father. Well, maybe they need a father, but maybe they don't need a father who's abusive, either to them
right.
or to the mother.
So we can all agree, I think, that, yes, children do need fathers, but children, mm-hmm. whether they need a father or a mother, is that person, they don't need someone who's going to be abusive. I mean,
right.
obviously, that is such a simple statement, but it's not really about the rights of a parent, in my opinion. It's about the right of keeping a child safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, remember courts were started long, long ago to handle disputes between people, and it was usually disputes about property. And we haven't come that far over the hundreds of years for courts, it's still somewhat viewed as property. You know, I mean, we don't like to say it out loud, but that's basically what we're saying. We're saying these kids are the dining room table and we both own it, so who's going to get it? Well, you know, if you're breaking up the dining room table, you shouldn't get it, should you? And yet in courts, if we're talking about children, you can have somebody who's very, very destructive to that child, and yet courts, with a few exceptions, you know, on some blatant things. I mean, if a man physically hurts the children, then they will count that as a negative. But if the man hurts the wife, they don't necessarily count that as a negative. A lot of courts will say, well, yeah, he abused the wife. We have documentation of that. But that doesn't mean he's going to abuse the children.
Right.
Well, really? Really? Yeah, you're an advocate.
Yeah.
How often did you see children from an abusive home who were abused in one form or another?
Well, and absolutely. And even if you take the concept of the effects of witnessing,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it be verbal, emotional, spiritual, physical abuse towards a mother, I mean, the best thing a father or a man or another partner can do is love that person and show them respect in front of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a child can become very fearful of what that person might do just by merely witnessing what is happening. They're being taught that this is okay, that this I have the right to have the power and control over this individual.
Right.
And, you know, working in the field, the best thing we can do is if a child discloses sexual assault, is to believe them. And what is a mother to do but to protect that child? It could be so turned around later on, and this is often what I saw see as advocates, is that the accusation of not protecting.
Yes.
Again, one of the talks that we talked about, well, why doesn't she just leave? Which ties into the fact that there's the simple assumption that she's not protecting her children if she doesn't leave. So
yes.
It's sort of you're caught in the middle of either you disclose this, you believe your child or not, and then it can be turned against you by saying that you're trying to alienate me from my children.
Yes.
So it becomes a really heated topic.
Yeah, well, and especially since, again, there are so many judges and there are so many lawyers that really don't believe that child allegations about sexual abuse are accurate and true. And, yeah, there are some false accusations. But the studies show that actually false allegations about sexual abuse are made, it's only about 3% of the accusations are false, and they're about the same as men's reporting sexual abuse by the mother. So whether it's a woman reporting abuse of the children or a man reporting abuse of the children, it's about 3% of those accusations will not be will turn out to be false accusations. But the rest of them are true.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we have a situation where it's kind of like damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you say, here's my child, here's supporting documentation from the psychologist, from the school nurse, blah, 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 that says that this child has been sexually abused, then the father can always say, well, that's her fault. It was her boyfriend. It was somebody. She wasn't taking care of these kids because it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't prove that it was him.
So, Heather, I'm a little bit more interested in this Gardner person. Where is that status right now as far as has it been recognized in any of the diagnostic and statistical manuals? You had said earlier that it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Although they fought really hard, there was a real campaign. The manual that psychologists use to name problems that people have. That manual was revised recently, and there was a huge campaign to include parental alienation syndrome as a legitimate thing listed in that book. And of course, they did not. Because it's not supported by the literature. The literature that supposedly supports this is not scientific literature. And so, I mean, you can find plenty of kind of like bogus scientific, quasi-scientific things supporting this. But in fact, the experts say, no, that isn't support. That is just, junk science. That's what they call it, junk science, where people kind of come up with things just to try to support their point of view. And phrase it, in a scientific vocabulary. And Gardner was a really interesting guy. He really didn't believe that allegations of child sexual abuse were, for the most part, accurate. If they were sexually abused by the father, then Gardner advocated that it was probably the mother's fault. He felt that, I have a quote from him. He says, this was in 1991, he said that Western society is excessively moralistic and punitive toward pedophiles. So he didn't really, he said that the prohibition of sex between adults and children was an overreaction. Okay, so he's kind of a creepy guy. I actually did a report on him, and although he was a psychologist, I never found any indication that he was a member of the American Psychological Association, which is like a lawyer not being a member of the bar. That's like, what? I also never found that he actually practiced psychology. He worked with children at a daycare at Harvard, which is kind of creepy, but that's about it. And the idea of this guy working with children kind of gives me the shivers. But his big claim to fame is that he started this parental alienation syndrome. If a guy had enough money, Gardner would travel around and go to courts and make big money testifying that, yeah, these kids have been alienated. And abusers love this. This is a great way. Accuser of alienation. The kids don't want to see me. See, there you go. Clearly, she's alienated them. And they've kind of made a business out of this because there actually are groups and organizations that will retrain your child who has been alienated. It's just real creepy. It's really a creepy, creepy thing. Gardner actually ended up killing himself back in the 90s. So he's no longer contention, an issue, but his theory of parental alienation has taken off, and in some judicial districts, in some areas, it's really quite scary, to the point where a woman might want to really reconsider reporting sexual abuse of her child for fear that she won't be able to protect the child, that she will be assumed to be an alienator or a liar. So it's really kind of creepy and scary.
Well, the topic is just very, very interesting, Heather. And again, for those who are listening in, please feel free to call in on our radio show at 646-378-0430. And the information that we're sharing with you today is just another segment or a tier of what potentially women face when they're in a domestic violence situation. And I just really appreciate the information, Heather. Any other suggestions that a survivor might do, or our society, courts, judges, when we hear this topic, is become educated, become aware. Anything else that we can think of today that we can share with our listeners?
Well, I think that you said the education of the courts and lawyers is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to understand that this really is not true. And for a lawyer, it seems to me most districts that I've heard of have a rule that says one partner or one parent cannot do custodial interference. In other words, you can't prevent, try to interfere with the relationship between your child and the other parent. So it seems to me that should cover it if somebody is, in fact, trying to sabotage a relationship with a parent. I don't see any need for parental alienation except to really kind of, like, beat up women. And the fact that it's just taken off is just astounding to me, that people actually buy that stuff without consideration that there are all sorts of reasons a kid might not want to see his dad.
Yeah.
So education is crucial, I think. Unfortunately, it's really difficult to educate judges. You know, it really is, for various reasons that we can get into at another time. But you have savvy judges, they don't buy this. But you have judges that are not so savvy, they'll buy right into this. The other thing that is important, I think, is for the parent, the abused parent, to learn as much as she can about this syndrome, supposed syndrome, and whether or not it's likely to be used in court. Now, in my particular case, I was accused of parental alienation, but the court system was well-educated and modern, and they just kind of like, and didn't pay it a whole lot of attention. One county over from me, though, it's a completely different situation. A woman is accused of parental alienation, and they take it seriously, and they end up usually kind of like punishing the woman in terms of custody, if they feel that this parental alienation accusation is accurate. So I think the victim has to find out as much as she can about this, and she has to find it out from other... She probably will not be able to find out about it from her lawyer. So she needs to go to those resources. She needs to go to those advocates and legal advocates who worked with this, who've heard about it, and who can tell her in her court district what usually happens when this accusation is made.
So really the importance of an advocate, and even though the attorney from a professional standpoint or the title attorney may seem as though they may have more information or they're more of an expert, advocates are key to this, it sounds like, that they really need to, it's an encouragement to work with an advocate. And I also want to encourage our listeners and survivors is that you yourself can become your own best advocate. And if this has been an issue for you and your attorney is not responding or listening or taking this matter serious, is to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
And do the research and know that this is not something that they should be working through in a court to really try to take the issue away from this accusation. In my opinion, it's a deterrent. It's a distraction.
Yes.
And that was really what this was about in this particular case that I was working with this survivor, is that the whole issue is now about her. And just the term of parent alienation syndrome makes it sound like somebody's crazy.
Exactly.
And so you end up defending yourself of not being crazy and being a good fit mother because you made these steps to protect your children.
I have a quote here from a document, a very extensive document, called The Evidentiary Admissibility of Parental Alienation Syndrome, Science, Law, and Policy by Jennifer Holt, judge. She's a judge. And she said that by July 19, 2005, 20 years after Gardner first described it, PAS was referenced in 64 precedent-bearing cases originating in 25 states and in 112 law review articles. That means that precedent-bearing cases means that that's like the first time it happened, and from then on, everybody's going to point to that as a way to follow, as a pathway to follow this, you know, in these kinds of disputes. So you got 64 precedent-bearing cases across 25 states and 112 law review articles where they're using this phony syndrome as if it's something actually real, you know. So, you know, it influences legislators, it influences, you know, lawyers, it influences everything, and the fact is it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Who was it? You might know this, Pinkley. My son is always saying this, that if you repeat a lie long enough, people believe it.
Yeah. Abusers can tell lies better than victims can tell the truth.
Yes. Yes.
That's the quote that I heard many years ago, is that abusers can lie better than survivors can tell the truth because they believe it. They're so ingrained in it.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, that's one of the reasons that a lot of times sexual offenders can pass lie detector tests, because they don't see anything really wrong with what they're doing. So they don't have that physiological response to, uh-oh, you know, I did something wrong here.
Right.
As far as what women can do who are victimized by this, I think, first of all, they have to understand that the dynamic that the abuser will use is to make himself the victim, to make himself appear the victim. And there is no better way of doing that than convincing somebody that your ex-wife or your divorcing wife is keeping your children from you, keeping your loving children from you. And it's a powerful, powerful thing. People feel sorry for a parent, especially a father, whose mother is keeping the children away from him. So if he can use this, you know, quasi-scientific but nevertheless fairly popular tactic of accusing her of alienating the children from him, he's got some power, and he's turned himself into the victim.
Wow, that's a powerful statement, Heather. And if you have an attorney that's backing you up and pushing this or even bringing it to the forefront as a possible or as a alleged syndrome, again, you are now, you are in the defense mode as a survivor. You are defending yourself as opposed to the courts and, you know, the jurisdiction at hand supporting you as a mother protecting your children.
Yeah, and that's really exactly where you don't want to be.
Right.
Unfortunately, for most of us who were victimized, by the time you are actually in the court system, you're so beaten down and intimidated and afraid that it's really difficult to be the dominant party. It's really difficult to be the aggressor. It's really difficult to stand up and say, you know, exactly what's happening and defend yourself against it. So it's really tough, and I would recommend to anyone who has gone through this or who is going through this, educate, and be strong and get support. You know, Deborah always ends our show with a wonderful quote, and she always does a lot of research on them. I wanted to end the show with one of my quotes.
Great.
No pressure, No diamonds. So just remember, when you're going through all the hard stuff, there might be a diamond at the end.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. Join us next week.